Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One. Thank you very much for taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those illustrious folks who are with us live, if you'd like to, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page if you're there, and that's where you'll find a link for the chat room. That's a great place if you have some observations about the show you'd like to share, or perhaps there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guests during the course of the show. Perfect place to roll in with the usual suspects, and we'll be monitoring during the course of the show. We'll be glad to bring your ideas and fold it into the conversation. Also, if you've got to go off and take care of some stuff on the honey-do list, you can catch all the rest of the show that you may have missed by accessing the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can simply take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes or Stitcher. And let's dive right into today's show. As they used to say in a TV program, I used to say, stripped from today's headlines, anybody that's been following the usual publications for all issues Navy know that the aircraft carrier in a variety of different forms has really been above the ambient noise recently. Whether it's the USS Ford that's been doing her sea trials recently, or the British getting their really nice aircraft carrier Queen Elizabeth underway without an air wing, but that's okay. You build a carrier, the planes will come. And the discussion has been ongoing, the carrier debate. Are they obsolete? Are they not? Are we building the right thing? Are there other things that we can build? Lots of conversation on there, an important conversation. And and I'll bring out in my first question, there's also a recurring question that always seems to come up every generation or two we want to talk about as well before we dive into the other related topics. And we think we have a returning guest today that is just spot on to have the right expert on board to be able to talk about these issues and other related ones. And that's J. Talbot Manville, Captain, United States Navy, retired. Tal teaches at the Naval Academy. While on active duty, he served as an engineering officer specializing in aircraft carriers. He served on three, assisted in the building of two, and at the end of his career, he was instrumental in developing the new Ford-class aircraft carriers. He's a graduate of the United States Naval Academy back in 1972. He's also earned a master's in mechanical engineering from the Navy Postgraduate School. And to round out his intellect, he also got a Master of Liberal Arts from our friends down the street at St. John's College back in 2008. Tal, it's a pleasure to have you back on board Midrats, and welcome back.
Well, thank you. I love talking about aircraft carriers, so let's get on with it.
Yes, sir. That's perfect. And I thought, because we kind of mentioned it in the pre-show discussions, and it is something that it broke into my news feed and a lot of others. And the Senate Armed Services Committee allocated what to you and me is real money, but in the national security arena is a few things that you scraped from under the couch cushions. They allocated $30 million to study a light carrier, something that it seems to come up once or twice a generation. And I thought, just to kick things off, is from your perspective and having seen this question get asked and answered a few times, what do you think here in 2017 brought the folks up on the Hill to say, hey, let's look at having a light carrier, or do we need one? And, you know, what do they find really attractive, and where do you think that conversation is going to go given some of the players that we have right now?
Well, I think first to answer the light carrier problem, I had thought that they also provided a hint in that proposed legislation that what would it take for an LHA-6 to have catapults put into it, and what would that cost, and so something like that. So there was some. So I had heard some discussion about that. But let me go back and start what we did 20 years ago in 96. The Department of Defense told the Navy that, and the Navy was saying it's time for a new aircraft carrier, and the Department of Defense said, okay, and you're going to have to put it under the 5,000 acquisition process that puts OSD in charge, not the Navy. The aircraft carriers had been grandfathered out of that process, but now with a new carrier, OSD was going to be put into it. And what OSD told me was to do, I had basically four things to do. I had to maintain the core capabilities of naval aviation. Obviously, the Navy had that as a big input. Improve the carrier's affordability, improve the interoperability, flexibility, create an architecture for change, and also reduce the total life cycle cost by 20%. And they gave me a goal. Now, the first thing that was done well, and it was done before the program started, was done by Rear Admiral Harry Rittenour and Captain T. Ladd Webb. And what they did is that they were on the OPNAV staff and fighting for what was in the mission needs statement. And that took them 18 months to basically negotiate kind of like the outline of those four principles I had there. But in particular, what was required was a critical capability to distinguish that platform from any other platform. And what they came up with, and it's brilliant because it's very much like the difference between way in which Dr. Langley approached flight and the Wright brothers approached flight. The Wright brothers knew that they were going to fly in their airplane, so they wanted safe aviation, okay? Safe flight versus Langley just wanted to fly, and he wound up killing several pilots in order to understand the difference that the Wright brothers understood. What Admiral Rittenour and T. Ladd Webb came up with was this, I thought was a brilliant analysis. In one sentence, they said, the critical capability of the aircraft carrier is that the aircraft carrier's air wing must simultaneously perform surveillance, battle space dominance, and strike and sustain combat operations forward, period. That's what it was. And so if a design concept didn't do that, then it was out. And so what we've – so I think the people who are listening are probably familiar with surveillance. That's the E-2. Battle space dominance is the fighters and the fighter roles. And also with the prowler growlers, I think the prowlers are out, so they're now all growlers, the AEW aircraft, and then the strike role for the strike fighters in the air wing that are in the strike role, which is basically the F-18s, and now the F-35s are coming in. And so one of the things we found out was, well, the first debate was, and we kind of broke it down between 80 aircraft were large, 80 aircraft air wings, 60 aircraft air wings, and the ships that could accommodate them in 40. And then we first analyzed three different battle space scenarios, one that was basically where there was really no real air threat, that all you had to have was alerts on the flight deck, but you were basically in the strike role, which was like how we fought, why we have been fighting in Operation Enduring Freedom and also with the War on Terror, where basically there is no air threat against the aircraft carrier. Then in the second one, we looked at what the Brits looked at, like in the Falklands, where there was a second world power like Argentina that had a fairly robust, is maybe too strong a word, but competent air force that gave them a lot of problems in the Falklands. And then the third case was something like a very demanding scenario, like the Eastern Med or the Taiwan Straits, where all the strike fighters, where basically there would be a high air threat against the battle group. And what we found out was, basically, the aircraft carrier, when in doing the simultaneously these functions, surveillance, battle space dominance, and strike, they need about 20 what I would call the overhead aircraft that basically does the surveillance, defending the battle group. All right, so you need 20 of those, and so that dedicates about, depending upon how you look at that, that dedicates about between 15 and 20 strike fighters, okay? So if you look at the typical squadron that comes aboard in 12, so on the small aircraft carrier with 40 aircraft, you need, you can basically take two squadrons of strike fighters to have about 24. And then if it's 60, you can probably get 25 to 30, and then with an 80 aircraft air wing, you can get up to be about 55 to 60 strike fighters, and you can then have the remaining aircraft are the overhead aircraft for self defense, recovering the pilots, and ASW and surveillance. So that's the way it kind of broke down. So there was like an overhead for no matter, driven by the threats, you needed at least 20 aircraft, the helos, the E2s, the growlers, in order to provide self-defense, and then the rest of the aircraft can be dedicated towards strike. And what we found out was that with the small aircraft carrier, okay, which is 40 aircraft, and, you know, that's a lot more than you have in an LHA now. If we were in a high-threat environment, virtually all the airplanes were dedicated to self-defense, none for strike. So, and we wanted to put that out, but we had to go up to the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Perry, and luckily CNO went in ahead of the time. And when we got up to this slide, it's a famous, you see three buttons in each little square of low battle space dominance, medium, and high. Dr. Perry turned and said, why are we still talking about small carriers? Because they cannot do the critical capability, and it was put aside. So then what OSD required for us was then to say, okay, let's look at the difference between medium and large. And, oh, by the way, you can't fully outfit the aircraft carrier. We want you to have less than a full complement so the 80 aircraft carrier can only carry 75, and the 60, the medium-sized aircraft carriers, can only carry 55 rather than 60. And we went, okay, whatever, because you can quickly surge airplanes if you can need them more. And I'll talk about that, about how we've been operating recently that way. When we looked at that, and OSD had a campaign model called Thunder that was for Desert Storm, and we invested well over $500,000 to go run this battle scenario. And the bottom line coming out of that battle scenario was basically the Persian Gulf gets taken over by a hostile regime, no carrier in the Gulf, we have to fight our way in. And so four carriers respond to the crisis in day 7, the first one shows up, day 14, the second one shows up, day 21, the third carrier shows up, and what do we get in a 30-day scenario? And so what we saw there was with the large air wings, 75 aircraft off the large decks, they generated 8,000 strike sorties out of about 12,000 total sorties. But the real measure was strike sorties. And the medium generated 4,000, okay? Now, if you look at the difference in cost between these ships that were required, and OSD wanted the medium carriers to be as robust as the large, which made them nuclear power, okay, because that gives you larger magazines. You can ask me why that is. But so they were both nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, but one was sized for the medium air wing and the large air wing. So, and the difference in cost was only 8%. The large carriers cost only 8% more than the medium carriers. But for 8% more, they got 100% more strike sorties, which was considered to be 100% more of the important performance. Then Dr. Gilmore turned to me when we presented this, and he said, "Captain, don't you understand? It's not the cost of the ships are the problem." "Oh, really?" "It's the aircraft." So Dr. Gilmore, when he was then PA&E, which is now has changed its name, and I'll have to think of it in a minute, but he was playing the devil's advocate. "Don't you understand it's the cost of the airplanes?" And so I said, "Well, sir," so we anticipated this, that our AOA, Dr. Dave Perrin, had anticipated that, and he then had the study do, let's put the medium aircraft air wings on the large decks. And when we did that, they flew 5,600 strike sorties in that same period of time just by changing the size of the decks. Why? Well, because the large ones, the large carriers didn't have to refuel as much. That was basically driving the unrep cycle for that 30-day scenario in the Persian Gulf. And they were much more flexible. So by just changing the platform, we got 40% more sorties. And Dr. Gilmore goes, "I get it. Okay, I get it. So we can vary the size of the air wing, okay, and keep the platform the same over a 50-year period, let's say, because that's the with a 12 class, that's how long the Ford class will last, well into the 22nd century, and we can vary the size of the air wing." And that's exactly how the Navy and the Department of Defense have managed the aircraft carriers over these 20 years. Back in 2014, when the Bush was the only aircraft carrier or the only place where we were dropping ordnance on ISIS, when the Turks shut down their field in Turkey, the Bush was, for 54 days, was dropping ordnance. They had 44 strike fighters, and they had 63 aircraft on board total. Recently, with two or three recent deployments of PAC fleet carriers going to WestPAC and obviously off of North Korea, they have gone with 80. And that's amazing because of sequestration. The aircrafts, the inventory, are about 50% of them are down, so they have been hot spinning a lot of the air wings in order to make that happen. But that was possible because of the size of the large deck. Dr. Gilmore got it then, and I think that things haven't changed in 20 years to make what we found in those studies any different now than then. Now, let me talk about an LHA, okay, LHA-6, which is the LHA without the deck inside, okay. And there, it's all aviation. The size of the magazines on the LHA-6, the USS America, is 16,000 cubic feet. The size of the magazines on the Nimitz class and on the Ford is 375,000 cubic feet, 23 times greater. To put this in some type of perspective where we can kind of look at the difference, a football field, it's very convenient that the LHA's magazines are 16,000 cubic feet, okay? If you reduce that footprint to a square footage and assume that the magazines are 10 foot high, and we're doing radcon math here, I think they're a little bit shorter than 10 feet, but they are much more than 8 feet. So let's take 10 feet. That means that the footprint of the LHA-6 magazines are 1,600 square feet, okay? A football field is 160 feet wide. So imagine a strip in the end zone that is only one-third the depth of the end zone. That is the footprint of the LHA's magazine that would be 10 feet high. Now, so how does that compare to the CVN's magazine? It's 23 times larger, and it would go from the end of the end zone all the way out to the 50-yard line and then another 17 yards to cover all of the magazine, the footprint of the magazines on a CVN. And much of that is driven by nuclear power, okay? And I'll talk a little bit that compared how the Brits handled this problem, because they did something that I think was pretty clever, but they made some trades that are kind of interesting. But just imagine that, the footprint of, imagine how many weapons you could store in rooms of 10 feet that go basically 67 yards long, and including that extra 10 yards in the end zone, 77 yards long and 160 feet wide. That's the footprint that you get in the CVNs. Why is that important? The smart weapons revolution that's come along, if the listeners Google, if they just Google F-35 weapons capability, the screen will come up and they will show, there will be drawings with the weapons that they can carry. The F-35 is planned for, although I don't think right now that they can do all of the 33 weapons, but there are 33 different weapons that the F-35 can carry. And there's a similar image like that for the F-18s. They can carry 27 different types of weapons. And then you also have the Growlers. Okay? So this new proposal, so when you think about that, well, 35 different types of weapons, and many of them are missiles, and that's the reason why they use the measure of volume rather than tonnage, because typically the tonnage is around 3,000 tons for the CVNs. I don't know what the tonnage is. It's probably 1/23 of what 3,000 is for the LHA-6. That is not a lot of weapons, so they have to figure out what weapons that's going to go on that deployment, okay? And so they're going to have to cut back from the 33 to what are they going to use? That's an interesting problem. So right then and there, you can see the trades involved by going to a smaller ship that's LHA 6 size. Now, as I understand it, the Marines are bringing back the well deck, so those magazines will be even smaller on the advanced LHAs, on the new age LHAs. So that's kind of the interesting part. Now let's look at how the Brits handled this, because they went STOVL, okay? But their ship's pretty big. They got two islands, and the two islands are important for this because they're gas turbine powered, they're electric drive, so they're generating, they got two 36 megawatt gas turbines in the bottom floor of their island on the flight deck, all right? And what that does, it saves over 100,000, at least 100,000 cubic feet of space for the air intakes and the exhaust, the smokestacks, that would, for the LHA-6, starts way down on the eighth deck, way down on the bottom of the ship. So the LHA-6 has dedicated over 100,000 cubic feet of space just for the air intakes for the gas turbines and the exhaust and the hot gas. And that gas coming out is much hotter than steam boiler gas. It's much, much hotter. So the Brits said, no, we're going to save that 100,000 cubic feet of space for our magazines because we're going to be carrying the F-35s. So they basically said, we're going to minimize our exposure of those paths for the air in and the smoke out, okay, and that's a big savings, and also an increase in survivability. But they've also put their propulsion, their power stuff, where they're exposed. They're up in the island. There isn't a lot of protection for them, as opposed to being down below the waterline like the LHA-6. But there, they gained a lot more space, okay? They gained a lot more volume, and I don't know what the size of the volume is, but that's one of the trades the British did. I also like, and I remember, because I went and talked to the Brits during my time from 96 to 2000, four or five times where we talked. I like the idea of two islands for basically separation for the interference, for the electronic interference between the comm and the radars. And so two islands was big. But aviators hate islands. Mitcher dedicated his entire life to try to come up with a ship, an aircraft carrier that would not have an island. And the United States, the CV-58, way back when, had a telescopic island that retreated down that never came to pass. But he wanted a flat deck, and that has always been. And if you look at the footprint of the Ford's Island, it's pretty small. And guess what? That island's got to have to change anyways for CVN-79 because it's going to have a different radar system. So how's that for a beginning?
Well, that's a heck of a beginning. let me ask you a question that some people thinking about, which is we've got some big deck carriers, and what we really need are some less expensive small, you know, they're making arguments, less expensive small carriers or medium-sized carriers, probably not nuclear power, but which carry, you know, a substantial, you know, let's say the 40 aircraft you were talking about, but which can go in company with one of the big deck carriers to kind of round out a force, or that can act on their own in a you know, with enough ammunition train and a fuel train, supply train, providing them with that. That's a mission concept. Is that something that was considered too?
Well, I think it is, because from what I've heard, there are suggestions like from that SASC proposal that they want to see a study of trying to put two catapults on an LHA, and so two catapults so it can launch an E-2. And I think that's where they're getting at. The big problem that the Brits had in the Falklands is they could not see the attacking aircraft from Argentina. They were on top of them before the ship's aircraft or the ship's radars could detect them, and that was well within side the missile range of the Exocets. So without an E-2, in fact, I would argue now with network warfare that the E-2 is probably the most important platform on a small carrier. So one of the things that's got to happen is that you have to have an angled deck, okay? You have to have an angled deck. Now, we also looked at, could we put a radar dome on a V-22 and have a V-22 go up? It has the fuselage that is somewhat the size of an E-2, so you could probably get 5 to 7 stations inside there where the guys are basically conducting surveillance and electronic warfare back in there. But no one was interested in looking at the aerodynamics of having a radar dome with the V-22 because of the way in which the blading was. So that didn't get a lot of there was no interest in anyone in the Navy or the Department of Defense to say, okay, let's replace the E-2 with a V-22 with a radar dome. I think the aerodynamics would make that impossible for that airplane, but I don't know that. But there was virtually no interest. Now, it could not fly as high as a E-2. The V-22 can only get up to 2/3 of the height of the altitude of an E-2, but that would be something that you would want. So one of the problems is that small carrier, okay, unless it's angled deck, in order to trap the E-2s, and I guess they also may want the growlers to come along with that, that's kind of difficult. But you kind of then go back to the scenarios where if it's a 40, if you're calling it a carrier, and that assumes simultaneous performance of surveillance, battle states, dominance, and strike. And so if you're not, then what gives? Well, what gives is what happened in Benghazi, right? Where was the LHA or the LHD when Benghazi went down? It was in the Eastern Med, and they couldn't get there in time. And part of that is also an LHA can only go, what, 22, 23 knots. You need in a windless day 27 knots in order to launch aircraft with the catapult, okay? So there, you got to get the ship's length. If you lengthen the ship becomes naturally faster, so you start talking about. The new locks of the Panama Canal are now 180 feet wide. That's pretty wide. And they are, I think, 1,800 feet long. So now an LHA of the future, basically they are, our ships, the LHAs in the past, have been driven by Panamax requirements. Our aircraft carriers are not. But so it comes back to whether or not if you still want to do simultaneously surveillance, battle space dominance, and strike. So what that does, if you cannot do surveillance, you don't have the E-2, you're always tied to the carrier then, or the carrier is always then tied to amphibious operations. And that didn't happen in the Med. And so the result of that was there was no immediate air-capable ship that could get to, that could help the poor fellows in Benghazi. When was that? Now some time ago. So that's one of the problems with this standing down. Now, the other thing that they were talking about was what they're kind of looking for, and we tried to look into this. I tried to put a well deck into our carriers, thinking that they want this super carrier that can do both amphibious ops and the aircraft carrier, which is basically strike ops. Okay. It turns out that the hull cannot be made strong enough with a well deck to have more than two shafts. So that gets to be difficult in order to generate 27 knots of speed in order to do CTOL. So that's another problem that goes. So basically, we're talking about a small carrier. But what we found was, are you going to, let's say you make a 40 aircraft carrier. That's about 60,000 tons. If you put in side protection, if you put in the magazines, nuclear power will save you over around 200,000 cubic feet of space so that you can have more mags. So that allows, that's the reason why if you look at the Forrestal class, they carry about 2,000 tons. The Nimitz class carries in a measure of 3,000 tons. So you get a third more capability, and also in fuel capacity for the air wing, and also the weapons handling. So you start coming down, and what we found was, if you look at this and you make it as robust, if this ship is now going to be the capital ship of the Navy still, even though it's smaller, it only costs 8% less. It doesn't, and so that's a medium-sized carrier. A 40 aircraft carrier, I just think there are too many problems with it. It will have to devote all the strike fighters to the defense role, and the air picture is only getting worse, not better in terms of the threats out there.
Let's pull the thread a little bit on, and there's a little bit of history here. I was hoping you could share it to listeners, because one of the big critiques that comes up about the Ford is they go cost. But there's a reason, whole ones of every class cost them more. But there's a little bit of history here. One of my little hobby horses that I like to jump on now and then has to do with some stuff that happened 15, 20 years ago through most of the first decade of this century. And that was a lot of assuming away of technology and program risk, where in the past we used to do things, we'd evolve things, we do it incrementally, make sure we get it right, so we didn't pay stupid taxes at one point or another because we miseducated ourselves on the technology risk. Take for a second and explain for a bit for the listeners how a decision was made last decade to skip a step in the evolution building towards Ford, and how that really bumped up the cost of hull one more than it should have. And what type of lesson should that have to future naval officers and civilians as we develop new classes of warships?
Well, it's an interesting problem. In 1998, after about 20 months in the saddle, basically Dr. Kaminsky, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, asked me through the RDA and the CNO, what is your best shot for your best carrier? And so we basically then said, okay, a large nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. And we looked at that, and we had looked at 500 technologies, and we came down with 15, a dual-band radar, you know, this plasma arc garbage disposal stuff, and 13 others, okay, and David McWhite then designed this. It was called the Expanded Capabilities, and he wrote a paper on it. I made him write a paper on it, even though we were being told evolutionary. And I presented the bill to the three-star admiral, the N8 admiral, who is in charge of the budget, and I put the poor admiral in the sticker shock. He looked at me with absolute contempt. And because the bill was, well, we think we can, with these 15 technologies, the ship will cost $6.5 billion. This is $1998, okay? But the R&D bill is $7.5 billion, and so the total is $13.9 billion. Guess what the cost of the Ford is? $13.9 billion. And my deputy, Brian Persons, picked up on this. He kind of started speaking up, saying, okay, boss, to Admiral Lautenbacher, who was in sticker shock. In fact, he walked out of the office. He wouldn't even talk to us. He was just so taken back. And so we knew we had to come up with an evolutionary approach. Now, we really hadn't looked at that time, but we then did for Milestone 1. We basically had to see how risky it was. And so we were only willing to then, so we came up with a three-ship strategy where we would have spread those 15 technologies over the three ships. We thought that we could get a phased array radar that could go on CVN 77, PEO, IWS. So, yeah, we can do that. And so we said, okay, so we get a new radar for the CVN 77, I was then given 77, the last of the Nimitz class, to try to make that as a stepping stone. We then said, okay, for the new, for the Ford, where it's going to be still in a Nimitz hull, we'll just do the propulsion plant with naval reactors, and they did a whole bunch of neat stuff in there to reduce components. The big thing that we learned about, if we were to reduce life cycle cost, you had to get rid of the number of components, and you had to get and the people that are associated with those components. And naval reactors led the charge in this. And just to kind of walk you through what they went from the Enterprise, here is one interesting measure. We had 4,800 main steam valves on the Enterprise, okay, at 600 pounds, but still 4,800. On the Nimitz, they reduced that down. And also remember, they had 8 reactors. They had 32 steam generators, 16 SSTGs, electrical generators. And so what they did, they went from 8 reactors to 2 on Nimitz. They went from 4,800 main steam valves to less than 1,200. They reduced the number of generators from 16 to 8, and half of those were just dedicated to the propulsion plant. So we followed that because, you know, Admiral Rickover, I consider to be the greatest engineer in the history of the world, and his people then reduced things down to where we went from four reactors. We still kept two reactors, but we only have now four steam generators rather than eight. We only have four ship's turbine generators, and they also did some other things down the propulsion plant that are classified that they don't like me talking about. But the real interesting number, because we had the electromagnetic catapult, the number of main steam valves went from Enterprise 4,800 to 12 to a little more than 1,200 to something less than 200. So there was a tremendous reduction in components, and the number of watch standers went from over 100 on the Nimitz class to less than 25 on the Nimitz on the Ford. So there was that's how you reduce life cycle costs. And that comes from the redundancy that got first established by Captain Shade in designing the Midway, where he wanted redundancy fore and aft, port and starboard. So basically you had four independent systems that was also followed onto the Forrestal class and on the Enterprise, where you had four independent propulsion plants and four and that powered four shafts, that powered four aircraft elevators, and four catapults. So on the Ford, we reduced that. Now, what happened was Mr. Rumsfeld came in, and I knew he was going to go for the transformational one, but I could not get to him. And Paul Schneider, who was then the acting RDA, was trying to get in to see Mr. Schneider because he knew he had been hearing about this word transformation that Mr. Rumsfeld was pushing. But then 9/11 happened, and so we weren't able to get into him before, because I was still around after the change of the administration, and I was locked to go brief him on this. So in 01, the program didn't get changed till 04. So we lost basically 4 years of trying to reduce that, and the OSD people would not listen to the program. Dr. Wolfowitz, I think, is responsible. He basically bullied the program. He canceled it. First thing he did was cancel it, saying it's not transformational enough. And then they basically had to put it in, but they did not. They had a pretty good risk analysis. For instance, the advanced resting gear was just a cartoon. When NAVAIR came to me and said, oh, here is the advanced resting gear we want. And it was basically two spools, which they have, of an electric motor that then was controlled. The two spools, what we have presently on the Nimitz class, is a single spool that compresses a hydraulic piston that basically where the wire that grabs the airplane is attached to one wire that's wrapped around that has two ends, and those are attached so it's a single wire over a single telescopic hydraulic piston that gets squished as the airplane hits the wire and pulls the wire out that then pushes the cylinders together. That system is naturally self-centering in terms of it's safe. It's built in safety because an off-center hit increases the tension on the offside where it hits, and the tension is less on the other side, and it's naturally self-centering. Now NAVAIR was telling me we had to use software to make that happen because now we have two spools that are piling out, and it's going to be controlled by software. That software is still not yet certified to land airplanes as we're speaking today. NAVAIR, and I can name the admiral who was the PEO of aircraft carriers who put that on. There was an understanding during my time because they came forward in 00 and said, we want to put the advanced arresting gear on the first forward. And I said, no way are we going to put both launching, the new launching technology, the emails, and the new technology of the arresting gear on the first ship. We're going to prove one. And because emails at that time, in 1996, I could take you to 12 entertainment parks around the country, including both Disneyland and Disney World, and the Six Flags Over America entertainment parks, and show you an electromagnetic catapult that was used to do that. And in fact, before I briefed CNO, Admiral Johnson in 99, I had gone to King's Dominion and walked around with a 26-year-old Virginia Tech engineer who went around. He had a clipboard that he wouldn't let me look at, but he went around and was doing all the checks for the rides there, including those that had linear motor technology that accelerated the roller coasters around. He then called up Old Dominion Power to make sure it was a July day, and he made sure that there was enough power for the day, any problems like that. And then he turned it over. Those rides then get turned over to college kids and high school kids to run the park. Sounds like a flight deck to me, where the average age is 20 years on an aircraft carrier. So that was the reliability. Now, NAVAIR also picked, I thought, the wrong vendor, General Atomics, because they had never made anything that was fit on a ship. And so their emails catapult was very, very complicated, very expensive. They did not have a good handle on it. The advanced arresting gear in 04, after the Department of Defense agreed that they would accept the advanced arresting gear on the 78, they asked them for $400 million, and they were denied. That, if they denied it, the program should have told them, we're not putting it on. We'll wait until we can get that $400 million of risk reduction in order to make that thing work. Well, it's like the old Fram Oil commercial. Pay me now or pay me later, but pay me. And we have paid well over $400 million, probably, I would say, closer to $1 billion to make that goddamn arresting gear work. But it has handled over several hundred 20-foot off-center hits, port and starboard, up at Lakehurst, and now they're trying to get the software so validated so that they can have land F-18s out there once the Ford starts to go out to work up the air wing. So right now, the only aircraft that can land are the Helos. But I'm pretty sure that by the time that they're going to go out and start looking to CQ the F-18s, that safety bulletin will be ready. So that's the type of thing. And Wolfowitz basically bullied the program, and no one would step back. And the other problem was, and I would also say that I know this from personal knowledge, that the Secretary of Defense was going directly to the CNO, who's not clued in on the acquisition side of the house. He doesn't get the briefs. The RDA gets all that. And so he was kind of going to that, and Admiral Clark at the time just didn't have the knowledge to kind of push back at Rumsfeld. So that's the problem what happened. And to me, I hope the Senate Armed Services Committee basically gives the acquisition power back to the services and out of OSD's hands, because OSD really are the ones the reason why the cost grew, because they basically forced the transformation technologies that were not mature enough to go on the Ford. But that's the reason why that ship should have been out before the Enterprise left the fleet in 2013. So that was what, 4 years ago. So the ship's 4 years late as a result of trying to do it all in one. But you may ask the question, though, and I could see Mr. Rumsfeld asking me, well, Captain Manville, don't we have all those 15 technologies now working? I go, well, all but one, maybe, and I don't know about the dual-band radar either, sir, and that was a victim of sequestration as well, where we only got one out of three phased arrays tested at Wallops Island. And hopefully that will come through, but they only made one set of that, so we're going to have to go to another radar system that's also being developed for the LHAs. But so, 13 out of 15 technologies, thumbs up. Okay, but you know what? That's what drove that cost up, and so that was part of the change that they did not listen to the services as well as they should. So I would put that right back on, and I would love for Dr. Wolfowitz to be listening to this, because I would love to debate him about that. But he's getting on in his years, and so I shouldn't want to beat up the old man, but I do.
Let me ask about EMALS, because as a father of a Super Hornet pilot, I'm a little concerned about some of these things. And are you saying now that EMALS is no longer an issue, and it's really only the arresting, I want to say only, but it's the arresting gear that's kind of the most troubled item now?
Well, there is a problem. There was a problem, and I'm using the past tense. I have not heard it being solved yet, but I'm told it's not that difficult to fix. And it was the fact that EMALS, its initial kick was actually worse than the steam cats, and it was causing the exterior fuel tanks that they would be their attachment points weren't strong enough and require a redesign of that. I am told that no, that's not that big a deal. They just haven't gotten around to fixing that yet. And let me tell you, that should have been taken off the table as soon as they found that out. And maybe they have, but I have not yet heard that fixed. And I heard Dr. Gilmore in his last testimony before Congress bring that up and he was with the Obama administration. At the end of 2015, so that's 2 years old. They should have fixed that by now. I don't know if they haven't done that, but that I understand that should be fixed. I am very surprised that that has lingered that long. But that's the only thing I've heard on the F-18s. What have you heard? Anything else? It's the outboard fuel tank that they're a problem, right?
Yeah, I think that's all I heard, and I'm just curious whether it had been a fix. And I believe it's Sal's question.
Yeah, and
well,
so...
Yes,
you know, I don't know why they haven't come forward and have said that. Maybe they have, and it's just been below the noise, but I'm kind of going, they were... because I don't know what else they should have been focused on if everything went well. I mean, the dead loads into the James River went very well. So I'm just wondering, you know, why isn't Lakehurst talking about, we got that problem fixed too. So that's still out there. But I can tell you this, that the program was... because it was under the gun, they were under the cost cap. I forget the name of the cost cap. It's named after the nun something or other. The cost cap that they were holding off on some things, and so and they were hoping to get some additional money, and that may be the reason why Lakehurst didn't get the funds to get the airplanes up there. To take care of that problem. But that does not sound like a problem because they can tweak the thrust of the EMALS pretty well. In fact, they haven't really tried, but always a selling point was that they could launch much lighter aircraft than our present aircraft in the air wing. So, I mean, there are other problems with, like, with the OBOGs and stuff, but that has nothing to do with the aircraft carrier program.
Well, hopefully the answer isn't, well, just don't put the fuel tanks on the F-18, because goodness knows the F-18 needs all they can get. I wanted to roll this by you. As my wife and I were helping organize some of my parents' remaining personal stuff, we were talking about how, you know, especially for my father, when he was 25 in 1957, what he saw in a quarter century from 1957 to 1982, huge change in technology and society, much different than my generation saw, you know, from 1992 to 2017, many more changes in technology from 57 to 82 than there was in the 25-year period from 92 to 2017, so much change. And we were just talking a little bit ago about the Enterprise, CVN-65. She served her nation for 50 years. And you look at the development that you outlined in efficiencies and material and safety for the engineering plant on the Enterprise up to the Ford today. As an engineer, as somebody who has seen this process up close and is pretty well up to speed on a lot of the cutting-edge technology you have, when you look at the Ford, and when the Ford becomes, Lord willing, serve her nation as long as the Enterprise did in 50 years from now, where do you see, from a technology or from an engineer's eye point of view, people should look forward to advances, changes in efficiencies and abilities from an engineering perspective for future warships around 2060, 2065 that people will see?
Well, one of the things that I would see is if you look at the drones, and there was recently, I don't know if you guys saw the 60 Minutes where the Strategic Concepts Office at OSD dropped hundreds of drones out of these little drones out of two F-18s over the desert. And these things swarmed like crazy, and then they basically dropped down. So I could see where our strike aircraft would also be delivering all these small drones. I also think the X-47B that was successfully able to land on the aircraft carrier, I think there's also a place where I think the F-35 and the F-18E&F will probably be the last fighters, manned aircraft, and I think that we will be developing those airplanes. Certainly, right now, I'm a little bit surprised that, but I think naval aviation does not support the unmanned aircraft, and probably for good reason, because of all the things that the manned aircraft can do. So I think there's some resistance against the X-47B, but I think they ought to take those two prototypes, put them in an air wing, and, you know, like, make them a tanker, and then maybe make them a ISR platform, and do that not in linear, but do that in parallel. And also, I don't know if the readership should read, there was a paper written by the Undersecretary of Defense, Robert Work, that basically talked about having that unmanned X-47. All of Russia can be covered from the oceans around the world by an X-47, an unmanned aircraft that could penetrate in the Soviet Union, and he'd draw that saying that, well, this is a game changer. So I think there's that. The other thing I think we'll see is technology to combat the there's technology that's classified that really won't want to talk about that, but of an armor system that can defeat shaped charges, and that needs to be brought into the fleet. In fact, we had it initially, and that got cut That was one of the technologies that got cut on the Ford that I was disappointed not hearing about that, because you know, with the proliferation of cruise missiles, I am concerned that our ships are going to be very vulnerable to that. And then if you just look at all the where the technology is going with the iPhone and the iPad and, you know, the Dick Tracy watch, you know, the Apple Watch, I think in 10 or 15 years we're going to have people that are, you know, that probably will be embedded with, you know, we've already seen that science fiction. I don't think that science fiction is that far from reality in terms of that happening, and that gets to me a little, you know, a little bit weird. It's all right for me to carry around a watch that I can get rid of, but I'm not interested in anyone putting any little thing in the back of my neck. but when you start to look at the stuff that's coming from the electronics revolution, but it's interesting you say that we have not seen that type of advance, kind of like in the mechanical world, but nuclear power, it's still right now with nuclear power that the steam propulsion plant is still the most reliable that we could have for us. We looked at steam propulsion 20 years ago, and we quickly put that aside, particularly if we were going up to 1,200 PSI plants. I was on two carriers. I was Chang on America that had a 1,200-pound plant. Now, we could steam that, but that took a lot of high-quality sailors to make that happen, and I was fortunate that I had those guys. But if you also look at the networking, the way in which our air wing can operate, where it's going to be interesting to see how just one pilot is going to be able to fly the airplane with all the information that's going to be coming at him. So I see the day of the single fighter as gone, and so that's coming. And in fact, smart weapons, one of the things about the Ford program that Dr. Gilmore later went from PA&E, he then became the head of testing, and he was going to really hold the Navy's feet to the fire in the sortie generation rate. The sortie generation rate, where the Nimitz class routinely does about 120 sorties a day, we've now bumped that up to that our minimum should be 160. On my time on the America from 89 to 92, I could probably count on my fingers of one hand how many times we got over 150 sorties on a day. But the smart weapons revolution has made that high sortie generation. You only really need it for the knife fight when you're in the Persian Gulf, where you can have where you need to be engaged, you know, in all three warfare: surveillance, battle space dominance, and strike, all at the same time. So, but once you get out of that high air threat environment, you don't need that many strike sorties. And so I was always surprised that the aviation community was still pushing it. They had an experiment with Nimitz where they basically did 300 sorties in one day off of Nimitz, but that they were just pushing they were trying to push the ship, and what they found out is that they basically ran the flight deck crews into the ground. So after 48 hours, those kids were done. And nothing broke. There wasn't any catapult that went down. The O2N2 plants weren't flexed because they were using OBOGs for the airplanes. And they had, you know, they were basically just touching and going. Well, but they were launching. But you know, whether or not the ship was maintaining the Mission 1 capability of the aircraft with their AIMD was not tested. So there were a lot of things that went on that, but to me, all that high sortie generation rate has been overtaken by the smart weapons revolution.
Oh, wow. This, Tal, I think we could talk about that and all the stuff that we haven't talked about yet for, I don't know, another week or so. But you've been kind enough to give us a little more than an hour today, and I want to thank you for coming on again. I think we'd really like to have you back to discuss some of those things we haven't yet chatted about. And is there anything you're doing in the immediate future that you'd like to tell our listeners about?
No, well, I've just the one thing, I'm no longer teaching at the Academy. I've retired there, and now I'm off trying to write the great American novel. I had a very unusual experience on Midway in 1983, and I found out I was involved in Operation Able Archer. So for people who are wondering, So I'm going to write something up where the Midway was fighting a duel with a Russian bomber squadron, and so I've been working on that. That's kind of what I've been working on now. And every once in a while, I get asked to write a letter to you to defend an RCOH or the Ford program, and I've written three Naval Institute or Proceedings articles about the Ford program, and I've written four or five op-ed pieces for the Virginia Pilot, and so I'm transitioning from to try to become a writer, so we'll see how that goes.
Hey, well, at a minimum, Tal, when you get your book done, we want to have you back on to talk about that, because that'll be a fun read. I'll just go ahead and make a preemptive assumption there, but do appreciate you taking the time to join with us today, Tal. Really appreciate it. Great discussion. And I'll go right with Eagle One. I could go on for another 6 hours here, but I think your family and mine would probably not approve of that behavior. Hope you have a great summer, and we look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you again.
Very good. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks again, Tal.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, sir, and thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Hope to see you next time. And until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.